thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus, episode 98, recorded Friday, September 13th, 2013. 500 in podcast years. Well, welcome everyone to the end of a very long hiatus for Digital Campus. This is going to be episode number 98. And we are joined today by our cast of regulars, even though at least 50% of our cast of regulars has departed for greener pastures. They have nevertheless returned to the greenest pasture of all, which is the Digital Campus podcast. So I am Amanda French, and I am at the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia. Hello, everyone. And we are joined by Mills Kelly, who is also somewhere around George Mason. Hi, Mills.
Hello, Amanda.
Tom Scheinfeldt is here. Tom, where are you right now?
I'm in my office at the University of Connecticut.
I saw a picture of that office. It's looking pretty swanky.
Yeah, I've been doing some construction. Yeah, unauthorized, but as we've often said, it's easier to ask for forgiveness than permission.
I did that once. When I was at North Carolina State, they gave me a little office, and I painted it brown just because I didn't like it white, and I did not ask for permission, and no one ever said anything.
Yeah, so that's what you hope for, I guess.
So we're also joined by Dan Cullen. Hello, Dan. Where are you?
Hey, everyone. I am talking to you from the innards of the Boston Public Library in Copley Square in Boston, Massachusetts, which is the new home of the Digital Public Library of America, our headquarters.
That's so exciting. So are you like Tom? Are you ordering up the mahogany bookshelves and the late 15th century Italian marble desk?
No, what I got to do when I moved in here was go in the cavernous basement, which looks like the final scene of Raiders of the Lost Ark, and scramble in this giant mountain of old furniture ranging from the 1930s through the 1970s. And so it is a mélange of really cool sort of 1930s wood furniture and wacky colored 1970s kind of UFO disco kinds of desks and chairs.
That sounds more awesome than ought to be allowed.
It is.
All right. And finally, we're joined by a brand new regular host of Digital Campus. I'd like to introduce you in podcast land to Stephen Robertson, who is the new director of the Center for History and New Media. Hello, Stephen. Tell us a little bit about where you're physically located right now.
Hello, everybody. Well, I'm on the opposite side of the center to Amanda, and my office is distinguished by its essential emptiness at the moment. All of my things are on a container that, for reasons known only to the shipping company, decided that going to Taiwan was the most direct route to Virginia. And so at the moment they're saying early October arrival in Baltimore before I get to put anything in my office.
Oh, my goodness. Oh.
So it echoes somewhat, which I apologize for, and otherwise it's pretty much as Dan left it, except that the standing desk that I remember from my interview was claimed by somebody else.
Oh, you are kidding.
So I am at a sitting desk in the empty office, formerly occupied by Dan.
I never went in for the standing desk fad. Perhaps I should have, but...
Well, it was a distinctive feature, I have to say, at the office when I arrived, but it's no longer here.
You don't have a standing desk, Dan, I take it, in your new place.
I'm using an old card catalog desk as a standing desk.
You are not, really?
Oh, that's so cool.
That is way too cool.
Yeah.
All right, we need pictures or else
it didn't
happen.
Pretty cool. Yeah, I'll live stream it next time. But sorry about that, desk, Stephen.
Should we explain what a card catalog is for some of our younger?
It's where you put your iPhone.
Well, I'm also going to announce a couple of people who are lurking on the podcast. This year at the Center for History and New Media, we have 6 digital history fellows. I think 3 of them have been here for a year already. So we have sort of a cohort of senior fellows and an incoming cohort. And we are joined by 2 of those fellows today. And the graduate fellows are going to be helping us this year with producing the podcast. So they're going to be rounding up some stories for us, suggesting things for us to talk about. They'll be, wrangling the website a little bit and wrangling the guest hosts and so on. And we even have one of the fellows has a brother who's a recording engineer, and she's promised to ask him about ways to make our sound better, which I'm very excited about. So that's
change the hosts.
Yeah, change the put them all in a room. Get it, let's say doable ways of making this sound better. But so we have 2 of those fellows here with us today. So we have Amanda Morton. Say hello, Amanda.
Hello.
And we have Amanda Reagan.
Hello.
Nice to meet you, Amandas. So if you hear people piping up with insights, that may well be, I think you have, a 50% chance that that's an Amanda. There's lots of Amandas on the podcast today. All right, so let's get to the meat of the matter. We have, there was a lot that happened over the summer, but we've consigned all of that to the dustbin of history. And we're just going to talk about some recent developments in technology. The first thing I wanted to talk about was the announcement by the MIT initiative edX that they are partnering with Google to expand what I think it's fair to say is a MOOC platform. Do we have any thoughts about this partnership? Maybe particularly from Dan, who is now in the Boston area.
I was sort of hoping to hear from Mills on this.
All right, first. Mills.
First of all, I just want to make sure I understand all of this correctly because...
Yeah, me too. That's why I was hoping you go first.
Because my options, if I'm a university president, my options look kind of like this. I could sign a contract with Coursera giving away, 93% of any future revenue from MOOC courses that I launched through their platform, which is very nice. I mean, I've looked over the courses. It's very appealing. So, but 93% of the revenue I give back to them. Or I could go with MOOC.org, this partnership of Google and edX, and do an open source MOOC, which costs me whatever my staffing overhead is, which I was going to have to pay anyway because Coursera Dalloway does some of that stuff for me. I still have to have people here concerning themselves with it. And my overhead will be higher because it's open source and I have to have some more people on it. But what if my course that I put out there enrolls 20,000 students, 5,000 of them are paying some kind of tuition for it, and I get to keep all that revenue? All that revenue, 7% of that revenue. It's a really hard decision I have to make as a president. At least that's what it looks like to me, a tough choice between giving away almost everything and getting to keep almost everything. So I guess if I were one of those venture capitalists who pumped $65 million into Coursera, according to their website, I'd be wondering what was going to happen.
Well, it's funny. I was recently looking into some of this stuff about the revenue sharing from some of these MOOC contracts, and I looked specifically into Georgia Tech's deal with Udacity, which had gotten some ink, and I think they had managed to get a look at those contracts. And in that case, it was 40% that Udacity would get. They would get 40% of any future revenue. And I don't think it even has produced any revenue either. But even that seems like such a large proportion. So I'm with you, Mills. You think, well, why would you not want to keep all the revenue for yourself? And it's hard to know, except that I think that a lot of times large enterprises, as universities like to be, they actually really like to pay lots of money and make sure that they have experts on board to answer questions and to sort of be at be at their beck and call. But
right, and there is certainly a lot to be said for plug and play, which is essentially what Udacity and Coursera are. That, you know, I mean, the faculty members still have to figure out a way to convert the content of their courses into the infrastructure of those two platforms, but they'd have to do that for edX as well, or MOOC.org. But then Coursera and Udacity really manage the back end for you, and so there's a tremendous advantage there, and you get the whatever marketing advantage you have from having your course on their websites, and so it's not like it's not that Coursera and Udacity should be giving away what they do, because they shouldn't. They provide a very useful and probably fairly expensive service to their partners, but it is going to be. It's going to be hard for presidents to justify to trustees why they chose to sign a contract with a very expensive partner or to go an open source route. It won't be impossible to justify that, but it's just going to be...
I don't think that is hard. It doesn't. You probably know more about these kinds of deliberations than I do, but to be honest, I mean, it almost seems like trustees don't have a problem with, you know, signing the expensive contract, weirdly enough. You know, I mean, I think it's almost, you could actually, you know, make an analogy with the reason why people continue to pay high tuition rates, which is that price is a signaler of quality, people think.
Yeah, that's true. That is the case. However, it's also the case that across the country right now, universities, colleges and universities are getting a lot of pressure about public pressure from people like, oh, yeah, this guy Barack Obama, to be a little more efficient in their operations and spend less of their students' tuition dollars on things which seem in some way inefficient. You know, when you have pressure coming from the White House and the Secretary of Education and on down, and many people on, especially public university trustees, I can't really speak to private university trustees, but public university trustees are politically connected, appointed, and, you know, not entirely free from political pressures. And so, I think it's going to be increasingly difficult for universities to justify going, public universities to justify going the lux route as opposed to the much less expensive option.
Yeah, I mean, the speaking to Amanda's point, Mills, just our experience, I think, from Omeka and Zotero are a little bit telling here, though, is that open source is often a hard sell to institutional customers, because really what they're looking for is not always the cheapest option, but the option that provides the most cover. Really, I mean, if you buy an expensive product that comes with a service level agreement, if it doesn't work out, you can blame the vendor, you can blame the product. But if you choose an open source solution and you implement it yourself and it doesn't work out, well, then that's your problem. There's no one to blame. And so I do think that there are institutions that will choose the expensive product over the free one. Just on a slightly different angle on this, I was trying to think about this in terms of like, well, what does Google get out of it?
That's always the
question with Google, like with almost all of their new ventures, like what the hell do they get? And then I was thinking, well, they have a product that they sell to universities, and that's Google Apps for Education. If this then gets bundled with that, which it looks like it might, that sort of can expand. They can start to be an enterprise vendor of not just email systems and document sharing systems, but they can start being a vendor of course management software. So that starts to then put them in a different place, and maybe perhaps put them not just competing with kind of Microsoft Live Mail, but also competing with Blackboard and other learning management vendors.
What I don't get about this, and my general confusion is still, and I think since we were last on the podcast, I think reality has sort of been crashing into MOOC world. There was a pause in that, San Jose State University program. There's now more research being done on them, which is, I think, something we discussed as being a really important element that hadn't been done before. I think, Mills, you had called for a lot more research on what's effective and so forth. And I think that there's a big pause here over the summer, also in terms of the business models. What I'm not getting, I feel like the software is not the issue. I mean, we know how to make MOOC software. I don't think that it's that fancy. I mean, there are people, in fact, at George Mason University, like Tyler Cowan, who just, like, I think he used WordPress or something and just, you know, and some YouTube videos and threw up a MOOC. I think the much harder question is the one about business models. And I just think everyone's now feeling, I think including a lot of trustees and presidents, that the jury's really out. And if you look at the direction of how things are going, we've moved from, you know, these giant Stanford and MIT engineering courses, which were getting lots and lots of people and no revenue, to now edX and others saying, well, maybe, you know, the model will be that universities will sell their courses to other universities. But I just think that we're in a moment of pause on these MOOCs and reflection on them. And I don't quite get, as Tom just said, where Google fits in, because I just don't think it's a software question, really.
It's such a good point, because, I mean, just on the business model thing, I mean, the thing that sort of startled me about these contracts with their high percentage of revenue given to these companies, Coursera and Udacity, is that what they are doing is providing a platform. So they're not doing any of the content, a lot of these, you know? I mean, it is the universities who is, you know, providing a professor and, you know, providing, you know, the stuff you're teaching. And I mean, where else is that the case? I mean, where is it the case? You know, Blackboard doesn't take tuition revenue.
But there's some interesting stuff buried in this about the data that's being generated on how students learn. So the Chronicle story on edX and Google has some, you know, cryptic sentences at the bottom of it about what kind of access Google's going to have to the learner data. And the San Jose State, you know, the stories on those courses had this kind of interesting mix of the way that the analysis of what's going on in the classes is coming from the providers of the platform. And I wonder if part of what Google will get out of this is access to some of the data that's going to decide where this goes. Because in the end, access to what is going on in these classes seems to be as important as anything else in terms of getting on to this going forward.
The other thing is, I think really my own view is that the future of the MOOC or MOOC-like thing is not the way that it's currently being envisioned by, I think, a lot of presidents and trustees. I think that there's some real interesting possibility about globalization of educational relationships among institutions that can flow through platforms like these. Because right now it's anything but frictionless for students to take a course, a George Mason student to take a course from the University of Melbourne or some university in Buenos Aires or something like that. There's a lot of friction involved, and these kinds of platforms can really reduce that. But there's work that has nothing to do with the software to make that happen, and that's all administrative work between those institutions. But the other thing is, I think, and that's resolvable, it's just a pain. And the other thing is, I think there's a lot of interest, especially in the STEM fields, in these kinds of delivery models for prerequisites or co-requisites for their curriculum in ways that it doesn't make as much sense in the humanities and social sciences. And I think there's a lot of interest in that. And there you're talking about a, you know, what amounts to something that would never add up to more than a credit, perhaps, and so isn't going to be a revenue generator, but is going to be a student success generator.
Yeah, it's sort of slightly divergent point, but I'm teaching History 390 this semester, and one of the things I'm going to, you know, I have an entire class on Google and how it works. I mean, I could do an entire course on Google and how it works, but in the course of that, you know, I'm just going to teach them a few little advanced searching skills. And from somewhere or other, I heard that Google had a quote-unquote MOOC on how to search Google. So I looked for this MOOC, and you can find it if you look for Google Power Searching MOOC, but it isn't, you know, it has some videos. You know, it doesn't look like a MOOC. It looks like a website, really. You know, and I think it did have a live component at some point, and they did, you know, they left the videos up, which a lot of times they don't in Coursera and Udacity. They had transcripts of the videos, which I was thrilled to see because I don't really want to watch videos. But I almost wonder if, you know, back to the question of what Google's motivation might be for doing this, you know, might be that Google eventually wants to get into the education business, you know, even educating people in computer science. I mean, it's a bit of a maybe a tinfoil hat theory, Certainly Google, you know, the fact of that Google wants to teach people to use Google is not surprising, but it was something that I wondered in any case. So, well, there's lots of other, you know, as Dan pointed out, there are a lot of things going on with MOOCs right now. What our intrepid graduate student producers are also going to do is put up more related links to related stories. So we'll have them put up lots of links to all the stuff that's been going on with MOOCs recently. But meanwhile, we can abandon the whole MOOC topic with pleasure and move on to other things that we enjoy talking about, such as ebooks. So we did recently see the settlement of the Apple ebook lawsuit, the sort of Big Six lawsuit that was accusing these publishers of fixing prices for ebooks. But there's not that much to talk about that, other than that suit has been settled. What might be more interesting is the launch of a thing called Oyster, which is it bills itself as the Netflix for ebooks. All you can read ebooks for $9.95 per month. At least some of the tech sites think this is a great service. It's in private beta, so you can't necessarily get an invite. I'm pretty sure nobody on this podcast has been able to try it out. Is that correct?
Not me. I signed up to get an invite, but I haven't gotten one yet.
So we will have to talk about it in theory. What do we think of this notion of a Netflix for ebooks or a Spotify for ebooks?
I think it's something we've tossed out on this podcast before as a great idea. I mean, maybe we've talked about it in the context of university press publishing or kind of the buffet model kind of a thing where you get presses would get guaranteed revenue. You know, maybe it's $99 a year, which is probably, you know, twice as much as the average scholar might spend on books for that specific press every year. But you could get a big chunk of their book, or maybe it's their books that are 2 to 10 years old, right? Some slightly backlist past some commercial window. So I'm intrigued by this idea quite a bit. And I think, you know, what a lot of people are experiencing with ebooks right now through their public library is they get the OverDrive app, which is used by, I think, over 80% of public libraries that have ebooks available. And they realize that they just can't get a lot of books through that system because the Hunger Games has a line of 1,000 people, and they're only allowed to lend each book one at a time, just like a physical book, for reasons that are complicated. But I think this idea of slightly older books and as much as you can read is really intriguing. I think the only problem right now is it's only for the iPhone. So I do most of my reading on my iPad, and I'm sure a lot of people read on their Kindle. Well, right now this is only for the iPhone.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that there are a couple of questions with this particular service. I agree with Dan that the business model seems like a natural one. The question, I think, for this service is just like the question with Netflix and other services, is can they cut the content deals?
Right.
You know, right now it seems like they've got one of the big publishers signed on. The question will be, can they get the others? You know, Netflix has this problem of, you know, 1 month they've got a deal with NBC and there are NBC television shows on Netflix. The next month, like, the deal expires, NBC wants more money, or that, you know, can't come to a new deal, and then those shows are gone. And you know, I think Netflix continues to be successful, but that's one of the reasons why they've started producing their own programming, is because there's so much overhead in trying to cut these deals with the big content producers. So that's one question. I think the other question is whether you know, this is a startup. The question is whether Amazon, you know, eats their bacon, because this seems like something Amazon could put together relatively quickly.
Yeah.
The Kindle.
Well, and you know, just as a, you know, from a naive point of view, just as a user of both Amazon Video and Netflix, it was really remarkable to me how Amazon has most of the recent release movies that you would want to see. And I think the reason that they do is they're not offering this buffet model. They do it on a rental model, so it's really like pay-per-view, which I, you know, my theory has been that, oh, well, the studios are much more likely to let you rent whatever movie it is you want to see for $3.99 a pop, than to get whatever tiny percentage of the $9 a month that Netflix gets from you.
I've started to use Amazon more and more for instead of Netflix. I've got them both, but I've used Amazon more and more because they have sort of the best of both worlds. If you're an Amazon Prime customer, they have a whole bunch of stuff, which is the buffet model where you can watch it for free. And then generally, though, if they don't have it in the buffet, you can pay, an extra $1.99 to get the show you want to watch pay-per-view. So that kind of ability to offer, you can get whatever content you want. Sometimes it comes with the packet. Sometimes you pay a little extra, but it's just easy. It seems like they could do something similar with the Kindle store.
Unless you want a whole season, in which case $1.99 an episode is a lot more painful than $9.99 a month for Netflix.
That was Amanda Morton speaking, by the way, which is true, except that's what I've noticed. Netflix is much better for TV series.
Yes, it is.
And then Amazon Video is much better for movies.
True.
I think probably because of that. Yeah. And so the equivalent to that in the ebook world is Amazon. Amazon is a pay-per-view, if you will, for ebooks. You buy, quote unquote, not that you really buy them, the ebook one at a time. It will be interesting to see. And Amazon has this lending program, which, you can borrow one book a month, which is lame, frankly. So maybe this will fill that gap.
Well, the other thing, for our purposes in colleges and universities is the question of how this is going to play in the student textbook market. And as that market moves more and more toward ebooks, at what point are college bookstores just going to be able to offer through Amazon or somebody, the $300 a semester ebook subscription, and then you get all your books for $300. And so, some semesters you pay a little more than you might have paid, and some semesters you pay a lot less than you would have paid. And I can see, 5 years down the line, 7 years down the line, something like that.
Yeah.
You can rent textbooks on Amazon now.
Yeah, you can rent them, but that's, I don't know, I haven't looked at it. Are the rental charges different per book?
They're cheaper.
But I mean, does one book charge one, yes. So it's like $3.99 to rent one and $42.99 to rent another?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think it would be attractive, and it would help with financial aid packaging if it was just a flat fee of, $300. We're just charging $300 a month for your textbooks.
I do wonder about the differences in between books and, let's say, TV shows. I think heavy Netflix users can like binge on a show, as several folks were just saying. And I think if Oyster gets good enough so that there's just enough that you could read a few books a month, I mean, that starts to be really attractive, right? I mean, maybe you don't get the latest bestseller, but you can, as Tom noted, just sort of buy that ad hoc. But I think for a lot of people, again, going back to the Overdrive app that a lot of libraries have, they're just, looking for something to read for the weekend. And I think it can fill that niche pretty well. I mean, actually, already with the content it has, it seems to have pretty decent content, enough that it's good enough that you can find something that you want to read for the weekend. So that seems like a kind of very different model than for TV shows or, live sports where, okay, well, God, I have to have cable because I have to watch the Patriots game or something like that. This is something where good enough actually could go pretty far for an avid reader.
I actually think, for me, the final, I guess the prediction I would make, not that we're at the prediction show yet, but I think that for all of these kinds of content, I just don't think it's going to be one solution. I think that there are going to be ways to rent it and borrow it and buy it and, all of that kind of thing. I mean, I think actually, Tom's point about Amazon Video having both models was a really good one, actually. And I think that in general, the whole landscape for music is certainly looks like this. There are places you can buy it. There are places you can subscribe to it. There are social ones. There's Pandora. And I think that's going to be true for ebooks too.
Well, and I think being able to, the different ways that you can read them is really important too. I mean, our libraries through the schools have ebooks, but they're not always very great to read as ebooks. because the platforms that they're on are not very good. So it's almost worth it to pay a little bit more on for a Kindle book that you can keep and mark up and read much easier on different devices.
Yep, I'd agree. All right, well, so that takes care of ebooks. And note my restraint in not grilling Dan specifically in his capacity as executive director of the DPLA about his desire to offer ebooks through the DPLA. I have restrained myself from even mentioning that issue.
Nicely done. Let's keep the firewall.
All right. So the next thing, I guess this is almost like a launch show, you know, stuff that has launched. The third and final launch I want to talk about is a thing called Topsy, which I'm very grateful to the graduate fellows for recommending to me because I had not heard of this. I had missed this launch, which apparently launched just a few days ago, around September 4th. Topsy is supposed to be a service that will let you search every tweet ever sent. Has anyone tried this out?
You did. I played around with it a little bit. Just
did it work, Tom?
The search results it brings back are a little confusing, I thought. Like, they're categorized in different ways, like, you know, tweets where this is the username, tweets where this is mentioned, link that they make a distinction between tweets and links. So the kind of results page, I think I will need to spend some time looking at and figuring out what all these, you know, these distinctions are. But yeah, it seemed to work. You know, I did the typical vanity search of my found history Twitter handle, and, like, you know, it returned, you know, many tens of pages of results, which makes sense since I've certainly tweeted enough in the last 6 or 7 years. So yeah, seems to work. My question is, like, again, how long before Twitter steals their bacon or changes their terms of service so that this is not allowed?
Well, what I was wondering and couldn't really find out, maybe I just didn't research it hard enough, was whether Topsy had done this in partnership with Twitter. Because
they must have licensed it.
They must have, because I don't see how. Well, yeah, through that service, whatever it is, that Knip, yeah, that lets you,
right,
gives you access to the firehose. So they must have paid a bunch of money through Knip to get access to what's called the firehose at Twitter. I almost wondered whether, this is absolute speculation, but I almost wondered whether Twitter hadn't gotten tired of waiting for the Library of Congress to offer access to its rumored archive of Twitter and had just said, hey, we're going to go to the private sector for that functionality.
It's also the timing of this is a little interesting, where I think it was just yesterday that Twitter, or maybe the day before, announced that it's going to have an IPO.
Right.
And so, you know, being able to show the, you know, anyone who wants to look, the kind of power of a real Twitter search, maybe I wonder if this wasn't kind of linked somehow to that. So, like, you know, this will allow businesses to go in and start doing a little bit of research with Twitter and find, you know, figuring out what kinds of information they can glean from potential customers or whatever through kind of a deep search of the Twitter archive ahead of this IPO to kind of boost the buzz and the price.
Tom, when you tried it out, was there any way to download the results or get them in any way?
I didn't get that far. I didn't see it, but it's right. Possible.
Yeah, there's an API, but I didn't see any other way to do it.
Yeah, because again, I'm sort of interested in this, again, for our specific purposes, you know, thinking about archiving and social media archiving, which, you know, is a topic we've discussed before. I mean, people are thinking about, well, will historians in 100 years be able to look even at Craigslist or at Facebook? And at least Twitter, you know, seems to be, you know, they recently launched, you know, the ability for individuals to download their tweet archive and so on. And of course, they have donated. They're giving data to the Library of Congress all the time, so it is at least being preserved, even though the Library of Congress is having trouble providing access to that. So, I mean, at least Twitter is doing better about digital preservation of its stuff than most other social networks. But But it's just interesting to me, you know, as you kind of point out, Tom, I mean, Topsy is sort of billing itself as an analytic service and not an archiving service. But it is, in a way, it's at least providing access to some of those Twitter archives that are otherwise really difficult to get a hold of. So I'm interested in it for that reason. Other thoughts about Topsy?
Well, I think, you know, just from a teaching standpoint, I think it'll be really nice, you know, a nice addition to, for instance, our History 390 course on the digital past is a way to get students to think about that, you know, that very large database of tweets as a historical archive, because, you know, up till now we could say that, but they couldn't really play around in it at all. And this app makes it possible, this website makes it possible to at least, you know, poke beginning in very beginning ways around in that big mass of tweets.
Yeah, that's true. I'm looking forward to playing with it.
I do wonder how it will affect, you know, people's behavior. I think the Library of Congress archive, once that goes live, will have the same sort of effect where I think people think Twitter just sort of streams by and it's forgotten. And this ability to really like narrow in and find what Tom said 4 years ago, to bring it back to haunt him. You know, it could affect, I think, how people use Twitter if this becomes widespread.
I mean, I really agree with that. I mean, it's a remarkable kind of reminder of the fact that we tend to think about Twitter disappearing off the screen really quickly. And the ability to recover anything that's going on is just not part of the way people think about it. And suddenly throwing that in front of people, I think, is an interesting change in what Twitter makes you think about. And if Twitter is actually something you can go back and find again, instead of something that, you know, you can be away for a week and come back and say, you know, what happened while I was gone? I don't understand it anymore. I really do think that it's a different kind of element coming into how people think about Twitter. People want to forget about what they tweeted at a certain point on certain kinds of things, and this is suddenly going to bring it back to haunt them.
Yeah, what did I say 4 years ago, Dan?
It's best that we not
now I'm nervous.
Tom, I'm looking through it right now over at Topsy, and it's just nothing but brilliance. It's really...
Wow, thank you.
It's just Shakespearean in its wit and depth.
And it's just so right. You got everything right. Everything
all right. Well, we'll see.
Every prediction.
I guess we'll see. We edited out all the profanity, so that was good.
Tom, profane, the deuce you say.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, because you can search it by influences, which is an interesting kind of category to give it. But if you think, you know, given the amount of trolls and everything else that dominate how people talk about Twitter, you know, the ability to access abuse is perhaps the most obvious missing element of Topsy at the moment.
Well, Stephen, I think it's time that we turn to a new segment. We should give this a clever title. This new segment. Right now, the title of it is Reports from the Center, I think. That's how I think of it. So we're going to, from now on, begin having reports from some of the various projects that are happening around the Center for History and New Media. And one of the main projects that the Center for History and New Media has been working on for the past few weeks is bringing in a new director. So this week we're going to begin our reports from the Center with a report from you, Stephen. What's going on at the Center?
Well, I guess all I can really report is exactly what you just said, that I've arrived, and arriving, I'm kind of, you know, desperately trying to avoid drowning and trying to learn out just what is going on at the Center while dealing, as I'm sure I don't need to tell either Dan or Tom or Mills or even you, Amanda, with all of the things that can't wait until I understand what is really going on. I guess in terms of that, you know, I can't actually share this in any detail just because it would take too long. I've spent this week sitting down one-on-one with all of the staff at the center, which is, I have to say, ultimately a kind of inspiring sort of activity. You know, you come in from the outside and you're aware of what people are working on now. You sit down with them, become aware of what they've done in the past, the kinds of things they could do if we could unleash them. And in that sense, it's been a real reminder for me what a kind of remarkable place the center is and just what is going on here. And I guess that does lead into one of the things that's kind of ended up on my table, which maybe is in some ways a disturbing thing to make everybody else aware of, but next year will be the 20th anniversary of the center, which maybe makes lots of people feel old, but 2014 will be 20 years. And I think that, you know, what that actually is going to mean concretely, we haven't really had a chance to think about. But we will mark that in some way, I think, probably in the fall of next year, probably at least in part with a kind of centre alumni conference or workshop or unconference maybe, and try and capture a little bit, I think, more of the past of the centre. Because in some ways, 20 years is a long time, and it's a long time in terms of centres. And certainly many incarnations and many different physical locations for the centre. And so I have to say I'm looking forward to that, and I'm sure we can bring that back in some form in the podcast or other as we move forward and trying to just imagine how one celebrates 20 years of something is that's as much of a moving target as the centre has been. And it certainly adds an extra burden to me to think about that I'm picking up 20 years of hard work and achievement for people across the time. But I think it is worth maybe pausing and thinking about 20 years of the centre and just how the landscape has changed since 1994. I mean, we're in a different century apart from anything else, but maybe metaphorically in all sorts of ways as well. I'm in, you know, in some ways in no real position to talk about what's going on in the centre beyond the fact that I'm here and talking to everybody and trying to find out what is going on and where we want to go. And I think, you know, hiring somebody new is particularly for something that needs to be as agile and self-supporting as the centre is a kind of opportunity to step back and take stock and think about where we want to go in the future and what we want to get part of. And we've just started talking about that, and we'll keep talking about it, and other reports from the centre will probably add to that. But certainly we're trying to do more in terms of letting people know what is going on at the centre. That's why, you know, we're going to add that segment. That's why we're going to try and step up our blogging and our outreach. That's why we're making the Digital History Fellows take on some of the job of that, and you're going to be seeing them on the centre blog regularly throughout the year, taking up the task of kind of talking about what we're doing on a day-to-day basis. And I guess, you know, we are kind of, you know, invigorating ourselves with new people beyond me. We had Lisa Rohde come on board the Press Forward project. We have Stephanie Westcott coming on board the Press Forward project sometime next week. And we do have the final approval to search for a digital history position here at George Mason. The ad hasn't been written, it's a long way from coming, but the job is coming. And that'll be another influx of new people to kind of join me and taking the centre forward. So, I mean, I don't know. I mean, maybe we want to hear some 20th anniversary first reactions from everybody else, because I think it is going to be an interesting moment to step back and think about the centre and where it's going as well as where it's been.
20 years in internet years is about 200 years, so maybe we can just call it the bicentennial.
Yeah.
I just love the idea of having a 20th anniversary conference, and Stephen, I just want to publicly welcome you as my successor at CHNM and wish you the best. And I think I've said that privately, but just so our podcast audience knows that we're all rooting for you, and we hope and expect for wonderful forthcoming things beyond the 20th anniversary.
Well, speaking of anniversaries, now might be a good time to tease our podcast audience about the 100th episode of Digital Campus, which is due to be released in roughly 2 weeks. I will just give you a hint about what that might contain. Digital Campus began in 2007. So in internet years, what is that, about half a century?
God, and you know, in podcast years, I feel like this is about 500 years.
About 500 years.
I don't know how Tom and Mills are feeling about it.
Yeah.
So I can promise that on the 100th episode, we will do a little looking back to that that 1492 of podcasting, that 2007. Which saw the introduction of Digital Campus. I can't wait. I cannot wait. I think that's going to be very exciting.
It only took our biweekly podcast 6 years to hit 100 episodes.
I took the word biweekly out of the header at one point. I think we did manage roughly every 3 weeks. Right. But
Occasional is probably a better. Well, hopefully, I think now we're reinvigorated and we're going to be moving ahead with with you guys at the helm, and I'm thrilled to be back after the summer. So thank you guys.
All right. Well, thanks very much, you guys. I will speak to you next time on the 99th episode of Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.